are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, February 3rd, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Washington Post political correspondent Dave Weigel will be on the program live from Iowa. Why? What's that? Oh, it's the Iowa caucuses today. Cannot believe we're finally here, folks. Meanwhile, after the Republicans block witnesses for the Senate impeachment trial, final arguments have begun today. And we'll talk about why they waited until Wednesday to acquit. And they could have wrapped this thing up on Friday or Saturday. Meanwhile, Joe Biden's best friends forever and the Republican Party want to start impeaching him now over Ukraine. John Kerry apparently would have run for president this cycle, but for a bank gig and some sweet conditions for windsurfing. Congratulations, you paid for Trump's Super Bowl party. You can call in and tell us how it was. Meanwhile, Trump adds six countries to his racist travel ban. Trump administration also rolls back restrictions on U.S. use of landmines. The House is to have a key vote on Medicaid block grants, a vote that could rival those ones on witnesses when it comes to the Democrats taking the Senate back in the fall. Meanwhile, Senate investigators interviewed the IRS whistleblower who claims interference with the Trump and Pence audits. The DNC changes the rules for debates. The only possible beneficiary? Me, Mike Bloomberg. Tlaib boos Clinton, and all hell breaks loose. Meanwhile, the coronavirus is close to pandemic. And the NOAA, the NOAA emails over that hurricane that was about to crash into southern states in this country show the damage.
Like Alabama?
Like, well, not quite. Exactly. The Mad King has wrought on our government, just even on the weather, as it were. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. Jamie is still recuperating from the flu. Michael is down in Washington, D.C., I guess doing coverage with the folks from the Hill. For the Iowa, I don't know if it started already. I don't think so. I think it starts tonight. Sadly, most of you will be watching coverage on this station where we will be having conversations with Ryan Grimm. Nomi Konst will be here holding down the anchor desk. Is that what we call it?
Co-captain.
Co-captaining the
Brendan likes maritime.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Co-captaining this ship. And of course, we will also welcome aboard Ryan Grimm via
all right,
via the foghorn. And Bobby Big Wheel from the internets and the future now, Aaron Kleinman, will be joining us via phone. And of course, we'll have multiple appearances from John from San Antonio giving us his numbers. He was going at it with Nate Silver on Twitter, big time.
I feel bad for Nate Silver.
Yeah, sorry, Nate. We may have other special guests tonight in our coverage. We're moderately committed to staying up until this thing is resolved in Iowa, and we will be debating that question as we go on. We'll have a bunch of videos. We'll have a fun time tonight. And of course, we will be here tomorrow night, too, for the State of the Union. We may or may not have a show tomorrow at the regularly scheduled time. We'll find out. We're also doing, of course, the debate coverage live on Friday night. The impeachment hearings we'll be talking about, or the final vote we'll be talking about, on Wednesday. I'm not sure exactly when that'll happen. My guess is maybe 10 or 11 in the morning, but we don't know. We will get around to impeachment more, but let me, I'll just tell you what my theory is. And I hopped on YouTube after the vote Friday and went down a list of about seven states, and the numbers I don't have right in front of me, but they start with Colorado, where by last measure, Donald Trump had a negative 14 percentage points favorability rating. And then I think the next was Iowa. I think that was 6 points. Forgive me, this is off the top of my head, so I may get these numbers screwed up. But between Arizona, Georgia, Maine, you have, and Iowa, you have Trump at somewhere between negative 6 and negative 2 on favorability. Then North Carolina, he's tied in terms of favorability. All those senators, Collins in Maine, Loeffler or whoever it's going to be, or Isaacson, not Isaacson, but Perdue. And remember, Doug Collins is running against Loeffler, who was appointed. And she was appointed because she was going to appeal to the non-crazies in Georgia. But now she has to act like a crazy to beat Doug Collins. And there's no guarantee that she will. But if she does, then she's stuck with all the craziness that she's had to exhibit and her vote to not even allow witnesses in. So they're worried about Georgia. Remember, they had they not stolen that election. Meanwhile, Stacey Abrams has been down there and she's been continuing to register people. Had they not stolen that election against Stacey Abrams, she would be governor right now. North Carolina, Tom Tillis is nervous. As you move west, Joni Ernst in Iowa, Martha McSally in Arizona, Cory Gardner in Colorado. Sullivan in Alaska may be a little bit nervous. That's why Murkowski voted to not have witnesses. She was only going to vote to have witnesses if they could have had witnesses. When it became clear that they weren't going to get four, they were just going to have three, I think she voted to not have witnesses to protect Sullivan, who had to vote to block witnesses. And then all of these same senators that I have just mentioned, they're all going to have to take a vote against Medicaid. And we'll get to that later, but as you know, Donald Trump's administration just decided to start blocking or block granting Medicaid, or allowing states to get it as a block grant. They do a waiver, so all the Republican states are going to do this. And when they block grant, not only do they get less money, doesn't grow with the need that's in the state, but then the state is basically unshackled, as it were, by any strings that the federal government puts on that money. And so they can start to add new restrictions, basically kicking people off the Medicaid rolls. And they can use that money for anything that they want, ultimately. We're going to get a couple experts on to talk about this more. But the bottom line is the House is going to vote to prevent the Trump administration from block granting. And then it's going to go to the Senate, where the senators are going to have to vote on it. So Tom Tillis, places where Medicaid has expanded and people are happy about it. Tom Tillis is going to have a real problem with that vote. There's a couple others. And we will talk about that at length, maybe later in the show. Meanwhile, turning to Iowa, here is Joe Biden. Now, when we talk to Weigel, I suspect we're going to hear a lot about it's all about electability. But Biden has been trying to make it like I'm the guy not only gets elected, but I'm the guy who's going to go in. And because Donald Trump is going to go away, I'm the guy who could talk to Republicans. I'm like the Republican whisperer. Sort of undercut his argument this week when basically half the Republicans in the Senate said, oh, we're going to impeach Joe Biden and we're also going to put his son on trial. And here he is asked the question on the Today Show with, what is this, Savannah Guthrie? Is that her name? Okay.
Let's talk about impeachment. The Republicans are on track to acquit the president this week. You've been someone who's talked about being able to work across the aisle. Is there anything about how this impeachment trial has unfolded that has shaken your faith in your ability to work with a Mitch McConnell or Republicans?
It hasn't shaken my faith in being able to work with at least somewhere between 7 and 15 of the Republicans are there.
Pause it. Now, incidentally, I don't know if I have it on my board. Oh, yeah, here it is. That's not what Joe Biden's been saying. Incidentally, I mean, just for those of you who haven't been paying attention, he's not been saying I can work with 7 to 15 Republicans in the House. I mean, in the Senate, he's been saying I can do work with the Republicans. Now, of course, that's on some level what it means. But now he's got to get a little more specific and he's got to sort of narrow this window a little bit. And again, there's nothing to indicate that Republicans are going to break ranks. Mitt Romney, who apparently everybody in the Republican caucus hates because he's such an annoying guy and walks, you know, the idea that he walks amongst mortals, I think is sort of rubs other people in the wrong way. It was Mitt Romney and Susan Collins, who is basically her existence in the Senate is on life support and they all know it, who broke with the Republican Party. Not on exonerating Donald Trump, but just on witnesses. On nothing. Virtually nothing. They are all, the pressure on Republicans is so great. He's just out of touch. But let's let him explain more gibberish.
15 of the Republicans are there. I think you're going to see the world change with Trump gone.
So you think you can work with Mitch McConnell still?
I think on certain things I can work with. And my hope is he won't be majority leader any longer. Because the other
Wait a second. First off, I don't know what Joe Biden thinks happens when someone loses as a first-term president. But there's not going to be aliens coming down with a tractor beam that's going to take Donald Trump and take him up into a different universe. Donald Trump is going to go when he's going to start some TV network. And all he's going to do is make any Republican who steps out of line with what Donald Trump still wants pay a huge price. It's arguable the pressure may even be greater with him outside of office. Probably not, but I'm not so convinced. Donald Trump won because of Mark Levin and Rush Limbaugh and all of these radio talkers who have been mutating the Republican Party with the help of Republican lawmakers. So the fact that he moves into that position is not going to change anything. And then Joe Biden working with Mitch McConnell. Well, I don't have to worry about that because I'm hoping the Democrats take the Senate. Well, if the Democrats take the Senate, then what's the value being able to work with Republicans for you? We don't need those 7 to 15 anymore.
And my hope is he won't be majority leader any longer, because the other thing I think is important is who's going to be able to go in and help Democrats win back the Senate.
Has it occurred to you that there's a certain irony here, that here the president is accused of and has acknowledged wanting to get information about your son Hunter and his dealings with Ukraine, and this process of impeachment has ensured that everyone knows about Hunter's dealings with Ukraine?
That's a good thing, and no one's found anything wrong with his dealings with Ukraine, except they say it sets a bad image.
Well, do you agree that it sets a bad image?
And my son said that.
Do you think it was wrong for him to take that position?
No.
knowing that it was really because that company wanted access to you.
Well, that's not true. You're saying things you do not know what you're talking about. No one said that. Who said that?
Don't you think that?
Whoa, pause it. Wait a second. Can we just look at that body language? We got to bring our body language expert into this. Here's Joe Biden like leaning in. Savannah Guthrie's like, whoa. Here we go.
His dealings with Ukraine, except they say it sets a bad image.
Well, do you agree that it sets a bad image?
And my son said that.
Do you think it was wrong for him to take that position?
No.
Knowing that it was really because that company wanted access to you.
Well, that's not true. You're saying things you do not know what you're talking about. No one said that. Who said that?
Don't you think that it's just one of those things where people think, well, that seems kind of sleazy. Why would he have that job if not for his father was?
Because he's a very bright guy.
I guess the question I'm kind of asking is, was it right?
His appearance.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he said he regretted having done it. Speak for himself. He's a grown man.
You gonna predict a win tomorrow night?
I don't predict wins because I'm superstitious, but I predict we'll do very well.
All right. They have a weird cut. I just want to be clear. That is a NBC cut when he says, like, he's a bright guy. And then they cut very quickly. So I don't know.
Which makes me think they might be saving face for him, that it got worse.
There's a lot of cuts in that.
It's unclear. I would like to see the raw footage. Maybe they'll put it on their website at one point, or maybe they won't. I don't know. But here's the bottom line. He's not going to get out from under this. You could be the greatest Joe Biden supporter in the world and say it's completely unfair. He can't control his son. Totally agree. I have kids. Believe me, they don't do anything I want them to do. It's very easy for me to imagine that someday Milo's going to be out there and trying to take advantage of my name in some fashion. Going around, like, I don't know, going into like Just Coffee and seeing if she can get a free cup of coffee or something like that, trading off my name in some fashion. But the idea is that you can't control your kid, but maybe Joe Biden should have said to the administration at the time, like, I might not be the greatest guy to do this because I can't get my son, or I'm going to call my son and say, look, you're making it impossible for me to do my job. Now, I understand Joe Biden's in even a tougher situation because of everything that went on with his wife and his other child who died in that car accident. So maybe he doesn't feel like he has that leverage. But at one point or another, you have to make a decision. You're either going to try and leverage it with the kid, or you're going to step back and say, I can't get involved in this. And he could come out with even maybe I don't know if there's an even more creative response to that. But the bottom line is there is no response that isn't going to keep a small percentage of Democrats, in the best case scenario, only a small percentage, from staying at home because they think that Joe Biden is just as corrupt as Donald Trump. And Joe Biden has tried to sell himself as the guy who's going to change that. That's the problem. If Joe Biden was up there and saying, like, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. Forget, you don't want to say Medicare for all. Just say, like, I'm going to make 4-day work week. Joe Biden gets up there and he promotes a 4-day work week. One thing when you get Joe Biden, 4-day work week. If that was the fundamental bedrock of his campaign, then I think Joe Biden would be inoculated from these. It doesn't matter if you think I'm a little bit corrupt, because you're going to get a 4-day work week. Or it could just be like, I'm also making a federal rule that you can use the word chicks again in, amongst whatever it is.
Hell yeah.
Dames.
Whatever it is that he would offer, if it was distinct from himself, when you're getting this guy, you're getting a guy who's not going to, you're not going to have to worry about this stuff, double dealing. The problem is he's doing the same thing that Clinton did, which was running on their personal attributes, running on their resume. And even if their resume is really strong, you're basically going to battle with a guy whose only skill is to undercut and make people think badly about you enough so that they don't come out. He is very great at throwing crap on people and making it stick. All right. I got to go. I got to get to these ads because we got Weigel holding. Let me just tell Weigel we're going to be there in a second. That's the problem that Joe Biden has.
As the only lifeguard in the projects.
Hey, folks, what if there was a 50% off sale happening every time you went shopping for razors? What would you do? I know. I don't even have to ask you to.
Be smooth as a baby.
There you shaved. Go. Well, shaving with Harry's is kind of like that. They offer premium blade refills for as low as $2 each. That's up to 55% off compared to the price of the Gillette Fusion Pro Shield. First of all, you also don't have to have like three names for your blazer, your razors, right? They're constantly junking up the razors. It's like it's like your Rambo. You know that scene where, I mean, I guess now that's a little bit dated, but like you're like Thanos or whatever it is. You get all your different utility belts on. For me, I love shaving with Harry's because it's simple. Sort of a classical design on the razor handle. I like the small razor head because it fits in my asymmetrical nostrils. It's a little secret. That's why I'm always looking down at the desk. I don't want to show that off. But Harry's doesn't inflate blade prices. They don't put these crappy, unnecessary features on their razors. Flex balls or whatever it is. Harry's is a return to the basics when it comes to this stuff. Good blades, fair price. They get their steel from Sweden. They manufacture their blades in a world-class factory in Germany. If you don't love your shave, you let them know, they give you 100% refund. And 1% of the proceeds are set aside for nonprofit organizations that are devoted to people, to providing people access to better healthcare for men's and veterans. Harry's has an amazing offer for our listeners of this show. New customers get $5 off a trial set at harrys.com/majority report. You get a 5-blade razor, a weighted handle, foaming shave gel with aloe, and a travel cover. You can join the millions of guys who've already made the switch. Go to Harry's, HARRYS.com/majority report to claim your offer. Also, as you know, hiring is challenging. There's a place where you can go where hiring is simple, it's fast, it's smart. Growing businesses connect to qualified candidates at ZipRecruiter. You've heard me talk about ZipRecruiter a lot. I'm not the only one who's had a great experience with it. Dylan Miskowitz, at Cafe Altura. Apparently, he's the COO over there. Well, he experienced how challenging hiring can be after searching for a director of coffee. I don't even know what that is. I have no idea where you'd find someone like that for his organic coffee company. Then he switched to ZipRecruiter, saw an immediate difference. And you can, too, by signing up for free at ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter finds candidates for you. Its technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. It's like you get your own headhunter. So you get qualified candidates faster. After posting his job to ZipRecruiter, Dylan said he was amazed by how quickly great candidates were applying. He found his new director of coffee in just a few days. Folks, you don't need Dylan Miskowitz to tell you this. I can tell you. Sam Cedar at the Majority Report. Use ZipRecruiter to find the guy sitting right there. Brendan came in. Boom. I mean, I'll be honest with you. There was a lot of competition for Brendan's job. We got a ton of great recruits. But Brendan came in when I'm not going to tell you what the secret, what he said, because, you know, next time I'm hiring, somebody will come in and say that, but. You know what he said, Brendan, you know. With results like that, it's no wonder 4 out of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, it's the smartest way to hire. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all size. Go to ZipRecruiter for free at our web address, ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority, M-A-J, O-R-I-T-Y. And lastly, one of our sponsors today is News Voice. It's the first ever entirely open, crowdsourced, and democratized platform for news. You can download the app for free at newsvoice.com/majority. Look, the vast majority of our news is controlled by about five corporations. They split it up into small little other like little entities. But the bottom line is, if you want to be a good critical reader of media, you need to be able to compare how multiple outlets treat the same story. The easiest way for you to do that is newsvoice.com. It's a free, like I say, crowdsourced website and mobile app. It lets you create personalized news feeds and maintain a clear picture of where your news is coming from and what political slants may exist. Other sort of assumptions that they make helps you aggregate news from corporate outlets, international outlets, local news, and independent media. It gives you access to every side of every story. It's fueled by its community of users who contribute to the platform by fact-checking, submitting stories and sources that are missing, upvoting stories, and writing story summaries. You can even comment on stories and debate politics with other members of the community at News Voice. And the News Voice Play feature lets you listen to your personal news feed every day through customizable audio news playlists. It's like your own personally tailored radio station for news. News Voice is next generation news aggregator and social media platform that values transparency, good journalism, and productive political discussions. Get totally free access by going to newsvoice.com/majority. I put a link underneath this video if you're watching on YouTube and in our podcast description. All right, quick break, and then we'll be right back with Dave Weigel. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program the Washington Post political correspondent, the author of the highly read, at least around here, I'm sure in other quarters too, email blast, the trailer available at the Washington Post, Dave Weigel. Dave, welcome back to the program.
Good to be here. Thank you, man.
So you're in Iowa.
I am. I'm currently in the Des Moines Marriott downtown, which is the media hub of the caucuses. And in some ways, I think it's good for America that not every primary state has a place like this. It's certainly interesting. I mean, if you wander around the lobby, you can kind of get a story done, depending on which campaign people walk into the room.
So how many days would you say you've spent in Iowa just this cycle alone?
Oh, easily 60, I think.
Wow. And
which
so
is less than Iowans who spend 365, but, you know, a lot compared to a lot of people who will have hot takes today. I mean, my hot takes will be informed or misinformed by spending a ton of time here.
So who's going to win? What are the numbers? Let's wrap this up quick.
Andrew Yang. No, I have no idea. I honestly, what's been interesting is that the Des Moines Register poll, which was buried, did not leak per se, but enough people had chattered about what might have been in it, that expectations are set at Sanders winning, Biden doing pretty poorly, Warren and Buttigieg being somewhere in between, which is actually a fairly good mindset for people to go into if Biden does okay. I mean, if a former vice president of the United States has been in politics for 50 years, gets second place in Iowa, I think his campaign is ready to call it a victory in a place that was not meant, you know, not very oriented towards him. And well, I think the people who support Sanders will laugh at that, but a lot depends on who comes third and fourth. And right. Frankly, being around the state, I would say it feels like, you know, obviously you're going to delete this if I'm wrong and just wipe the show, take the Sam Cedar show off YouTube. So that'd be cool.
But if I'm wrong, forget it.
But it felt like Warren picked up in the final week. Just there were people who had never written her off, but moved to other candidates who were taking a final look at her. Buttigieg has been pretty flat, but kept revving up these pretty decent sized crowds. And Amy Klobuchar was pushing a storyline that she is surging at the last minute. I think it's true that she's a very popular second choice candidate for a lot of people, and that she's going to pick up people who a month ago would have voted for Buttigieg or Biden. It's not clear that she did enough of that to get out of fifth place.
Wow. All right. So, okay, there's a lot to unpack there. First off, we should tell people that the Des Moines Register has what is considered to be the gold standard poll, and they decided not to print it and release its results because one of the people who were administering the poll had changed the font size. Wait, what happened?
Okay. So, yeah, one of the people at the call center that was administering the poll, what we have learned is that they probably were reading the questions and expanded the font to the wrong size so that Buttigieg. Keep in mind, they randomly read the names, so right. you're going to see a sheet with names, and then the next person you see the sheet's different. They might have left him off, not asked him, and they just happened. I mean, the odds are basically 1 in 5 or 1 in 6 that they were calling a Buttigieg voter. The Buttigieg voter was frustrated, or I can't characterize it, I don't know, Tim Herr. They called the Buttigieg campaign, and the Buttigieg campaign called the Des Moines Register to say something's wrong with this poll. And so this is a situation that probably could have been resolved that night by the poll. Frankly, had the Buttigieg voter just said, "Hey, where's Buttigieg?" And they figured it out. But I'm not a pollster. I just kind of analyzed them. And the decision was just to say, "Well, if there's one flaw in this system, you know, if the glove doesn't fit, like we're just not going to run the thing." But the effect that had is that there probably was going to be a poll on the front page of the newspaper tomorrow, just leading discussion of Sunday shows. Tomorrow, am I talking about? From the newspapers yesterday, leading discussion on Sunday shows that would have showed Sanders still ahead is what a rumor we all have all heard.
Yeah.
There was not one. And so I think that added also to a sense that Sanders can never get a fair shake from the media. I mean, he was holding a big rally right when this was supposed to happen. That would have been a big deal for them, and they didn't get it. But it probably did, again, help Joe Biden, because people in the know expect Sanders to win pretty decisively and don't expect much of Biden. If he does okay, he comes in a second that's pretty definitive, then hey,
I feel like
people will say that he had a great night.
I feel like that's been the dynamic, though, for months. Is like if Biden, like, you know, that if Biden comes in third or fourth in particular, he's in big, big trouble. As long as he comes in second, he's fine. And as long as he comes in like second or third in New Hampshire, he's fine, because South Carolina was going to be his big firewall. It also appears, though, that firewall, I mean, it's hard, right? Because we just don't get enough polling out of these places.
And that's actually a real change from previous cycles, is despite this being very closely watched and competitive. I mean, I was just in my newsletter, the trailer, which I was going to hype at the end of the call, too. I've been in the run-up to Iowa and the run-up to New Hampshire, I'm kind of going through the history of previous caucuses and primaries, say what people got wrong about them, or how we remember correctly and incorrectly what happened. And there, you know, even the Obama race, it was pretty clear. There were three candidates at the top. Obama was picking up steam. This has been really murky, but there's been less polling than there was in 2016, which was not as complicated a race. And a little bit of that, frankly, is there are fewer media resources to pay for polls, and a lot of the resources are going to impeachment polls and not to this. So we know less about the race in terms of data than we did before. Now, some campaigns have their own internal modeling, and if you talk to the campaigns, they generally feel, you know, pretty good about Sanders winning, and then a fight over who gets the three tickets behind him.
There is Now, if I remember correctly, you were not somebody who was going to Iowa in 2004, right? I mean, that was a little before your time.
I wasn't. I never got there until 2007 when I started covering Republicans and Democrats there.
Have you asked people, like, you know, because there's a comparison to be made in terms of Dean and Sanders, at least on in the narrow sense of Dean had a lot of outside volunteers come in. Now, I imagine Sanders has more Iowan support. It's just that he also has an enormous amount of, I think, volunteers coming from outside. They superseded their own estimates in terms of what they wanted to call by, it seems like, millions of calls. There was one narrative that came out of that 04 thing with Dean, and I don't know if I ever believed it, but one of the narratives, like, Iowans just got sick of, like, you know, the college kids coming in. Have you brushed up about, have people said that in terms of Dean, or is that just like people just sort of running out of stuff to write about?
Yeah, so that's one of the things I tackled in the newsletter, because it's that was not as much of a problem for Dean. Now, any campaign can have canvassers come and they don't do a great job. People made fun of the orange perfect storm hats. The campaign branded their volunteers in a way the campaigns don't usually do. I mean, I think they claimed about 3,500 volunteers in the state, coming from out of state, I should say, which was less than they had hoped for. They asked for 5,000, they got 3,500. The Sanders campaign has more than 2,000. And it is not a problem for people. I mean, canvassers are not, "Hi, I'm from here and I'm going to lecture you." The Sanders strategy has been more persuasion at the door, having conversations. When you talk to Sanders volunteers, this is a thing that's very interesting to report, but it's as a reporter, you know, you can't just interview people working for the campaign and say, you know, have them rat out voters. But you can get a sense of what they've been saying. And they'll say, yeah, we at the door, somebody was on our list. They infrequently caucus. We talked about Medicare for All for 15 minutes, and we marked them off because they seemed convinced by Sanders. And that's not what Dean did. But the problem for Dean, which is not repeated by anyone this year, is let's relive 2004 again. I mean, so he was not like a left-wing candidate. Howard Dean was a fiscally conservative governor of Vermont. And when he started running, he was, "I'm going to run as a fiscal conservative who will bring universal health care responsibly." Then Iraq happened, and he became a left-wing candidate. So he was very vulnerable to attacks, both on the war position by people like Joe Lieberman, and then from the left by people like Dick Ephardt and John Edwards on, "Hey, this guy has said in the past that Social Security should be on the table," which he did. And so he got brought down by a crush of voter confidence in, is this guy reliable? Is he a real Democrat? Which is not a problem for Sanders. And frankly, Sanders has not been facing attacks. There have been a couple of negative ads on the air. More negative ads against Biden by Republican groups than one negative ad by a Democratic group against Sanders, which you have seen. Well, if you're in Iowa, you see the ad of six Democrats worrying, very sincerely worrying that Sanders is too old and unelectable. You see that a little bit. But, I mean, in 2004, it was like a rampage of ads with Dick Gephardt attacking Dean's actual statements on things like Social Security. And it's very hard to compare that to Sanders.
That dynamic is fascinating to me. I mean, I read your piece about that with Dean, and I remember, you know, him being a fiscal conservative and it sort of just going away because I think he was for not marriage equality, but he was the only one who had done, I think at that point, like civil marriages or civil unions, I guess it was called. And his big claim to fame on the left was that he had done sort of this grassroots fundraising and, you know, sort of the nascent, like, get money out of politics crowd or get corporate money out of politics crowd. That was what was inspiring. And of course, his like sort of full throated arguing against the war. But that dynamic of entering the race, thinking your candidacy is going to be one thing, facts on the ground or whatever it is, that there's no room for you to do that, and you change, but your legacy positions still hang with you. That dynamic could apply to a lot of candidates in this race, I feel like.
It could, but this is just the way that we always try to interpret a race is by going back and looking at the last couple of races. It's just the way, if you see a cloud looks like a face, you say, "Oh, the cloud looks like a face." And you don't think that is a collection of raindrops. So this race is different, but there are people who've tried to ape what worked for other campaigns. Pete Buttigieg, most notably, has really tried to copy the Obama message, but in a sort of smoothed down version, where Obama had kind of a 1-2 punch, which was, I represent change, I'm exciting, and also, you can't trust Hillary Clinton like you can trust me. Whereas the Buttigieg message is really just, I represent change. And occasionally, like a whack at the left over Medicare for All or something. It's not as potent. And frankly, there's not, the problem for Buttigieg, I think, has been there's not the same desire to punish the Democratic establishment as there was in 2008. I mean, I was looking at exit polls from 2008, 8%, I'm trying to do the math here, but I'm a journalist, like 1 in 12 people said their number one issue was electability. And that this year, in every poll, has been much, much higher. I'd be surprised the exit poll is not like 50% tonight. And it's just tougher to break through if your message is we need to change Washington, we need something fresh, and we can try something new. It's easier in a year like 2008 people think the nominee will probably be president, and it's been a while since a Democrat was in office. It's harder now when people miss Barack Obama and they just want somebody who can win. So Biden, who's run a less exciting campaign here, got a later start. I mean, the crowds are smaller. There's still a sense by his rivals that there are just going to be people who show up and say, well, I'm nervous. I know who Joe Biden is. I'll vote for him. And that's not something the other candidates could have counted on.
I mean, I guess Buttigieg, though, it seems to me, was also hurt by the fact that, like, when he entered the race, he thought that I think he was going to run to the left of where he ended up in. And, you know, when he came out with like these programs on how I'm going to revamp the Supreme Court and how Medicare for All is actually a compromise position. And I think that sort of left him orphaned in some way. But let's talk about this thing with the electability, because it sounds like from on the ground there that's the argument that everybody is making going into the last week, is that I'm the most electable of all the other candidates. And I guess that must be a function of, like, if you're undecided in the last week going into the caucus, it's probably over the question of electability.
That's very accurate, I think. And I also think it's important to imagine what the conversation will be tomorrow into New Hampshire. Because one thing that opponents of Sanders did not do is what Republicans did to Ron Paul, very different candidate, but Ron Paul in 2012, they basically agreed, look, Ron Paul is going to get like 20% or so of the vote, and he ended up coming in third place, really right behind Mitt Romney and Rick Santorum. He's going to get that much. There was actually one poll where he was leading, and the agreement of commentators was, okay, if he wins, Ron Paul has a small base, and he got lucky in a split field, and he can't actually win here. And so we're going to choose a candidate who is electable. I think that there will be voters in the last minute who ask themselves who's electable, and Sanders has done some work to portray himself that way, but not in a way that's convinced most voters. So that will be, I think, a factor. I can imagine people coming into the room tonight, and the last minute deciders will not go for Sanders. His strength was with having organized for a year and pulling people out. I think there are last minute deciders who might choose Warren because she actually has close with a message that some campaigns think is silly. We'll see, which is that she is the candidate who unifies most Democrats. She doesn't anger any one part of the party. And her ads, even, she has been running ads later than other candidates, and her final ads, which you see all the time, are ordinary Iowans who voted for different people in 2016 explaining why they're voting for her. I've seen that stuff go before, and it kind of blends into the background. But in the caucus rooms, that will be the argument, is like, look, we have some candidates here. You think Joe Biden could win. Some people only like Bernie Sanders. Here's the candidate who unites everybody. The problem for her is that Buttigieg is not seen as that alienating, despite everything we know about how he's run his campaign. I think that he or Amy Klobuchar could get some of those voters, too. So it really is there could be a blowout tonight, but if it is a split where the candidates at the top get less than half the combined vote, I think that's going to be a lot of the analysis. It's like, what did we learn from this when most voters didn't want either of the top two?
Interesting. And I would imagine there's a similar dynamic going on in New Hampshire, right? Like, after Iowa tomorrow, people in New Hampshire start to take their cues as to who can win based upon what happens in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Well, so New Hampshire voters are ornery. I think we start using the words rock ribbed and whatever. A lot of cliches get deployed to describe how New Hampshire voters, just, they take their primary very seriously, and they don't like to be told, hey, this is happening, so you should turn around and vote for this now. So there is a chance. I think what would happen if Sanders is victorious is a push in New Hampshire by other candidates to say, okay, do you want him to run away with this because he's a divisive figure? And what that's where the result tonight will matter. So imagine if Biden does extremely well and he can say, look, it's me or him in New Hampshire. He has had a very flagging campaign there. That would give him a chance to reorient it. If there is a kind of cluster and Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar keep running and don't drop out of the race, and they argue that, you could have, I mean, I just said why you can't compare every race to every other race, but you could have a situation like 2016 where Iowa happens and Republicans say, oh, well, okay, well, Trump's got 27-30%, so good for him. We can figure out later which of us is the anti-Trump candidate, and never do it. Never do it until it's too late. There are very big differences because 75-80% of Democratic voters really like Bernie Sanders. And in the very beginning, Trump had a hard base, but also the biggest opposition among Democrats, even though
Republicans, like I remember
Republicans.
I remember watching that, like
telling themselves, and it wasn't wrong.
But yeah, I remember watching that figure of like never Trumpers went from like 80 or 78% down to like 22% by the end of the whole thing or something. It was crazy. I mean, I'm making those numbers up, but yeah, that was the trajectory.
I think we have like probably the same articles floating in our heads, these like 538 pieces that say, here's some data that proves why Trump can't ever win. And then that was one of the data points.
I will say that whenever I saw those pieces, I said, they don't know what they're talking about. But that's the other thing that comes up. There was a piece by Ron Brownstein today, or maybe I don't know when it was, over the past couple of days in The Atlantic, saying that that Biden's people are like fine with Trump, with Sanders winning in Iowa, as long as, you know, none of the others perform too well, because they think that Sanders has a ceiling. Is that the case? Because that to me seems misguided. I mean, obviously they all have a ceiling, and maybe Sanders doesn't have the highest ceiling, although I'm seeing polling that suggests that maybe he has a higher one than people think, but
higher, but not like Trump did. And we already discussed,
right?
How,
I mean,
how that things have changed.
I you know, I brought this up a million times, but I got a call from a Politico reporter in 2015 doing a piece on Martin O'Malley in the spring of 2015, saying Martin O'Malley, I'm doing this profile on O'Malley, and O'Malley has a question for progressives. How can he get them to support him instead of Elizabeth Warren? And I said, Warren's not running. They got to worry about Sanders. And the guy just laughed. He like literally laughed. And I'm like, I'm serious. And he goes, you're joking. And I'm like, I'm serious. And I still get the feeling that there is like these huge swaths of people in the Democratic Party, and it could be even Biden's campaign, who just, it's impossible for them to imagine that Bernie Sanders, I mean, we hear these stories that on Wall Street, they're afraid of Warren, but they're not afraid of Sanders. And people interpret that as like, well, Warren knows how to get to finance. And that may be the case. But I also suspect that part of the reason why they're not afraid of Sanders is because like they're not capable of believing that he could win.
Yes, I think it's a combo of those things. I mean, frankly, I don't talk to a ton of brokers or people like that, but
it seems like the Biden campaign thinks that too.
Oh yeah, but I talk to financial people and they just can't get around their heads that Sanders would win, and they assume that if he was nominee, he would lose the general election. So they start with those assumptions, and they just don't calculate the risk. It's like none of these people read that, you know, what's that pop science book, The Black Swan, or
right.
No one read that. Also, no one lived through 2016. And it's like every election is a little bit different, but there's a reality right now where Trump has an advantage, but he is trailing in polls to Bernie Sanders, who everybody already knows is a socialist. And people point to polls and say, ah, yes, but, you know, only 20% of voters have a good opinion of socialism. yeah, they have that, and half of them say they want to vote for Bernie Sanders.
Right.
There's a lot of kind of wishful thinking around him. I think there is something to the critique, and this is why Warren has done very well with a lot of D.C. leftists and progressives who, you know, every time they endorse again someone who's not Sanders, they get piled on. But some of them really do. They've seen her work, and they think she is more effective and has a quicker understanding of how a president could use the levers of power than Sanders does, that right. She's actually not thought about being president forever. She just understands how the system works. There are people who think that, but that is not really I don't think that is motivating Republicans. And part of it, this is just me consuming media and thinking this. I just think as media diverges more and more, Republicans don't know what liberals think, don't know what leftists think. They kind of, conservative media's coverage of the left is, did you see this person say something wacky about transgender people, you know, or did you see this, this leftist college professor say something insulting? There's just not much of a reckoning with how the Democrats think or the left think. So in 2018, that led to just Republicans assuming every Democratic primary would be a crazy person winning and they'd run on impeachment. And no, Democrats are pretty cautious. The member of the DSA convention, which is I went to and a lot of reporters went to, on the right, the only thing they covered was somebody saying that there was loud clapping and chatter in the room that triggered him, and nothing about the agenda of DSA. So they don't pay a lot of attention to what the left is doing. Now, they could, but it's been a couple of years of this, and they do seem to be more interested in laughing at Hillary Clinton, which has been a very good moneymaker on the right, but not very good understanding how Democrats think, how they vote, who they vote for.
Yeah, no, I think that's the case. And you came from that beat a while back. And so you've probably seen the evolution as much as anybody, if not more. But I'm curious about, like, if the Biden campaign really does think that, like, if we aren't watching that dynamic of, like, you know, I don't need to be the one to take this guy out because somebody else will. And there's just no way he can win. And I think that, like, that is a miscalculation. I mean, there's a little bit of awareness. I mean, we have a clip of Chris Matthews, bless his heart, almost, I think, having a quasi breakdown because he seems to have, like, over the past like week or two, woken up in the middle of the night and seen, like, you know, a vision of Bernie Sanders winning the Democratic nomination. And it seems to have terrified him. But there doesn't seem to be that awareness that it's possible. Like, there just doesn't seem to be, like, people are taking him seriously, his candidacy seriously, in a way that I think is, like, preventing them from, I mean, I don't know how they would go at him, but from going at him.
I think that's part of it. We've been going through all the factors one by one. I think we'll assess them again after this, but they've already priced in, Sanders might win Iowa, New Hampshire, but surely we'll take him out later. If you back up a few steps, this is extremely predictable. There were a lot of Democrats who talked themselves into thinking, well, he had a heart attack, he can't come back. He's still, after he had a heart attack, remember, keep in mind, he's running against Michael Bennett, who has had prostate cancer. He's following in the steps of John Kerry, who won the nomination after having prostate cancer. Voters are tolerant of some things. So it's not good. I mean, you'd rather not. But this is a candidate who had the most donations, the most supporters. And they just said, well, okay, we're going to take out Elizabeth Warren now because there's no way Sanders can come back. So you have to wonder about the political acumen of strategists who say this thing that clearly could happen is something we should not plan for and then panic about at the last minute. That generally is not how you win. I'm not saying they can't. And the other thing, the elephant in the room here is that Sanders supporters online and elsewhere, I'm not going to be pejorative about them, but I'm not pejorative of anybody's supporters, but they are very quick to on the trigger if something looks like it's unfair, faster than other campaigns. I mean, I dealt nine with this week with people, Sanders organizers who'd recognize me, and they'd ask if the DNC was going to get rid of the superdelegate reforms, which it's not. They're just a couple of members who are kind of ornery. They asked about if the debate rules were changed in order to stop hurt Sanders. Kind of not, because there's even Sanders people who think it would be great to have Mike Bloomberg on stage, and the rules don't do it. And I've just met people who thought the poll release would stop. So in all these cases, there's a hyper-awareness by Sanders supporters and a lookout for a ways they will try to screw him over. And you can't run into that by saying, all right, time to screw him over. And that is a good comparison with the Trump campaign in 2016, because his message was entirely, I'm the anti-establishment candidate and they hate me. So the establishment said, all right, we're going to put on our villain mask and run into Iowa and start running ads against you. It is very hard to do that against Sanders. What would need to happen is basically polling that every Democrat sees that shows Sanders losing the election and Biden winning it.
Right.
And that doesn't exist right now. So without in the absence of, now, it doesn't exist right now. Is there something they could do that would make that exist? Possibly, if there's a national conversation that really hurts Sanders. But so far, it's taken the kind of magic bullet theory approach of negativity, where there will be a story about something Sanders said or did or wrote in the past,
right?
And his supporters laugh it off because they're like, yeah, he's been here forever, he's consistent. I think there might be attacks on his policies and whether they'd be weak against Trump or polling results that show this. But I mean, credibility is hard to get back, and we've already seen polling from Third Way about how Medicare for All is not popular, and nobody noticed because we know that Third Way will release polling that agrees with Third Way's principles. Sometimes from focus groups that, if you asked the question another way, would have said that Medicare for All is great.
Well, it's also hard, I think, for Democrats. I mean, I think that what you're sort of getting at is if. Some Joe Biden outside expenditure group, Super PAC, started running ads against Sanders nationally to knock his numbers down against Trump. That would be parlayed into the most effective attack on Sanders in the primary, because he has positions that, to the extent that you're critical of them, like, you know, Joe Biden and Pete Buttigieg, and they've all come out and said, Medicare for All bad. But the reason why it's bad is because, not because it's a good policy, it's bad because it has bad political implications. You're going to lose in a general election if you tell 150. Yeah, and so there's no,
not very inspiring.
They're not attacking him. They're not, they can't attack him in a way that resonates with Democrats, except for the most part, electability. And when you have polls out there that say he's beating Trump almost as badly as Biden is, that's a really hard sell to make.
Mm-hmm. I think that is a hard sell. And another thing too is that voters are buying kind of a package. The Sanders campaign is not going to say, if he's elected, we're not getting, we don't have the votes to get rid of this private insurance right away. But there's been a desensitization, and because of years of being told, you if you support any kind of health care reform, you want to take away people's doctors, all of this. Sanders also, so I think that if Sanders comes under pressure on that, he's very comfortable arguing for it.
Right.
He's not comfortable saying how much it costs, but it's not 100% clear voters care. The problem that Warren came into is that her constituency was some leftists who were supportive of Sanders in 16, but a lot of kind of comfortable middle class voters who are worried that a new government program would be bad for them. And the question is, how many of them would say, I am willing to support Donald Trump for 4 years. I, a suburban voter who voted Democratic in 18, this is enough for me. I'd rather not vote, or I'd rather vote for Donald Trump than vote for this candidate who supports Medicare for All. I think that's, again, none of this is me saying that'll never happen, I'm ruling it out. What I'm saying is we're making a lot of assumptions, and
right.
Sanders opponents especially are making a ton of assumptions that might not come true.
Let me ask you this, and I also, let me have my own also sort of caveat here and qualifier. I am, I think it is, we're going to find out tonight, and even after tonight, it's still extremely early in the race. But clearly, Warren had, had reached a peak and then dropped. The Jonathan Chait, if you're to believe his perspective on this, she dropped because of her embrace of Medicare for All. But as far as I can see, looking at the numbers and the dates, she was already in the Medicare for All camp. That I got the sense, and this was sort of backed up, actually, from You know, and it's not a perfect sample size, obviously, but I was reading through some of those Ryan Grimm emails that he got off his email list of people why they changed. And some of, you know, and of course you read these things and you're always looking for the thing that validates your perspective on this. So it's with all those qualifiers. My sense is that it wasn't her embrace of Medicare for All that was problematic. It was her having her responding to the calls for her to justify the expense, and her doing that was problematic. Not so much with the leftists who wanted some type of pure version of Medicare for All and who, you know, interpreted it as like she had Pete Buttigieg's plan. I mean, I think we hear from those people, but that's because they're more active. But rather just that there was this controversy around it, and she seemed to be defensive, you know, in presenting that plan, which I should note, Bernie Sanders does not have a financing plan. He has a couple of suggestions as to where the money's going to come from, but he hasn't done anything close to what she did. But by doing that, she was responding to her critics in a way that made it seem like she was less confident about her candidacy than maybe she should be.
I think that's fair. And so the irony of this is that her plan, so there's disputes about whether her payment plan and her decision to say the middle class taxes will not go up for this is the problem. I think there's something there because what Donald Trump does is say we're going to do everything for free and someone else is going to pay for it, and his voters don't care. I think Democratic voters tend to care more if they are told something can be done and there's going to be no cost to it. And so Sanders, just by saying yes, we're going to raise your tax at some point, I think that might have been Warren's mistake, is not saying even something like, okay, we're paying for 80% of this with higher taxes on the rich, but you're going to pay this much more, you're going to take this much more out of your paycheck, and you'll never have to take anything out of your paycheck ever again to pay for health care. That might have been more convincing to people, but I think the rest of the analysis is right. And it's a really interesting distinction, because it seemed less like Warren is serious about this. Warren's campaign always wanted to have, it was one of the markers they wanted for the campaign, was we will also be the campaign that explains how everything is going to get paid for. So they wanted to do that, but they decided to make it pass the test that no voter will worry that their taxes will go up. And that was kind of old school Democratic thinking. One thing you hear from veterans of the Obama campaign is that he ran all middle class tax cuts, and in the final polls, as he was voting, voters thought he was just about as good at lowering taxes as John McCain was. That thinking is different now, because the Trump cut taxes. They were extremely unpopular tax cuts that cost Republican votes, and it's popular to say I'm going to get rid of them. But this is a whole thing. I mean, it was strange to watch, because Warren still gets a lot of enthusiasm. She gets big crowds. She's in a position, I think, where she'd get a chance to come back. But the surprise, I think, two things happened to her campaign. One, she could have done that and gone back to more moderate suburban voters, but Pete Buttigieg existed. And she could have done that and gotten a cushion from female voters who don't like the idea of voting in Iowa and then they're having an all-male primary. But Amy Klobuchar exists, and she's got some of those people. So Warren's in this strange position where, you know, the difference of 2 or 3 points tonight would make it look like either she has come back and she is going to be one of the finishers in New Hampshire on Super Tuesday, or it could make it look like she made terrible mistakes and is never going to come back. And I don't know. We have to wait a couple hours to find out.
What are the different metrics? Because I know that you need to get 15% of the delegates or the votes to get delegates, right? I've been told by there's a threshold, but I've also heard that out of Iowa, there's like four different metrics that they're going to use. Can you like explain that to us, if it's possible that it's explainable?
Yeah. It's not that hard. So first thing to know is that we're going to know everything at once. There's not going to be – so people go into a room. They say, hey, get into the corner of the person you support, and voters will go into their corners, and there will be a count, and people who did not get 15% will be asked, okay, do you want to go to another candidate or do you want to leave? That always happens. There's a couple of subtle changes this year, but that always happens. What is new this year is that the party will announce at the end of when polls are coming out. Sorry, when results are coming, they will say, here was the vote when people first got in the room. Here was the vote when they finally sorted things out and got their final preferences. So this, what those final preferences are doing is saying who got the
second choice votes.
They're going to very closely mirror who got delegates in the room. The thing that gets really confusing is that the word delegates has to get used a lot. In that room, people are going to choose delegates to the state, the convention in their congressional districts. So basically, they're choosing, all right, we got 15 votes for Warren, we got 15 votes for Sanders, that's it. We elected one delegate for Warren, one delegate for Sanders, and they're going to go to the next round. That is how the party selects delegates to the national convention. So when people say four numbers, I think they could say three, but the reason there are four is because you're going to get one, the raw vote of when people walked in the room, which is going to include, you know, people who stayed strong and voted for John Delaney; two, the vote at the end of the night; three, how that end of the night vote translated to these, you know, caucus by caucus delegates. And then the fourth thing you'll get is what that means in terms of delegates to the national convention.
Okay.
Those are the four. So the least important number, funny enough, is probably the delegates to the national convention. That will move, I think, the CBS study of this from their poll is pretty good, which is that can move in pretty subtle ways. If there is a Sanders victory, it means probably two more delegates for him. If there's a Biden victory, it means two more delegates for him. In a race, we're about, you know, California's going to vote pretty soon, and they have hundreds of delegates.
Right.
So that's the least important number, but that is the fourth thing.
Okay. So let me just go back over that. That's interesting. So if we think of Iowa as a mechanism in which shows momentum and influences, particularly in this context, right, like electability, it seems to me, and you've made this point, is probably at a premium. And I think that's because, you know, we're talking about, you know, there's an incumbent president who's a Republican who everybody wants to get out of office. So the first one is the raw vote. That's what everybody who is running will have some representation there. The second one is the actual sort of like traditional result, which is after you've caucused, who emerges. So the difference between the end of the night and the raw vote will tell us like who people migrated to, right? On some level. Mm-hmm. We don't know specifically, but we'll see like, oh, John Delaney had 10% when people entered in. And then, you know, that bump was spread amongst, you know, these three other candidates, let's say. Then you have the mini delegates, as I'm calling them, which will go and elect the state delegates. But because Iowa has so few state delegates, that is the least relevant, because they will take place at the convention. They'll be counted at the convention. They're just not that overwhelming in terms of force. Well, this has been
not really. It's just that the party didn't used to count that, and now it's counting that. And so there are four, but basically that the second preference number is going to be the most. That's probably going to match up with the delegates in state, in
right,
the room and statewide.
Okay. And so number one will be, we will hear a lot about that raw vote if it in any way diverges significantly from the second one, because somebody will find utility in it.
And this is not inside information, but imagine Sanders got, you know, 26% in that first round, and then when people resorted, Joe Biden got 27% and Sanders said at 26. I think the Sanders campaign would say, you know, they would put out a press release saying that we're proud that we won the first count, and we're going on to as victors to New Hampshire. And the Biden campaign would say we won. I don't think it's as bad as having two popes at the same time or right, something like that. But that is what the conflict would be. One crowd will say we got. And they'll have something to stand on, because they will be able to say, look, this is a divided race. But when people have a second chance to look at the candidates, when they have another think about it, they don't go to them. They go to me.
Right.
I think there are a lot. There'll be a candidate who says that. And, you know, it could be at this moment in time, you know, before we know anything, it could be a Pete Buttigieg comes in lower and everybody has him as the second choice, he would rush into New Hampshire and say, I am the consensus candidate. I'm the one that, I'm sure he'd have an eloquent way of saying this, I can't do right now, but after a year of people trying to make this choice, I'm the one that everyone's comfortable with.
Well, and that's the thing, it seems to me, is that if you're any of these other candidates besides Sanders, right, let's presume that he's going to win because that's what the polling is telling us. The whole game is to undercut that narrative that he had a decisive win in Iowa because you don't want it to influence New Hampshire. And the way you do that is by just muddying the waters. And this is where, like, suddenly, frankly, Twitter becomes a very important arena because, you know, everybody who's writing their takes off of this, you get a lot of people who are motivated and then a lot of people who are going to be influenced by it. It's going to be fascinating. Where are you going to be tonight? Are you going to be just sitting in that Marriott? Do you just hang in that Marriott for the rest of the day until you get on the plane to go to New Hampshire?
I have to help with some kinds of coverage. I don't think I will cover a caucus in person. I've done it before. It's super interesting. It's definitely a thing you should do once, but like we're in a situation where there's minute by minute. How should I be spending my time? And if I'm spending an hour with bad Wi-Fi, not helping figure out what's going on in the race, it's probably not good. So I think I'm going to help analyze the races. I have a newsletter coming out pretty shortly, then another one coming out in the morning that'll analyze the races. But then I'm going to go to probably the Sanders and Warren events. Even the Buttigieg and Biden events are actually on the same campus at Drake University. They're the ones I think you'll see people walking back and forth between. I think I'll see that, and then I'm going to head to New Hampshire on one of the campaign planes. 11 hours or so, 12 hours.
Wow.
Depending how long this takes.
Nuts. All right, man. Well, good luck, and we'll be in touch. Would love to hear from you again. All right. Dave Weigel, always a pleasure. Thanks for giving us so much time. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. Dave Weigel, ladies and gentlemen, get on that trailer. Learn something. Fascinating. I mean, it really is going to come down to that divergence in metrics that are going to come out is going to be big because we're going to hear people, you know, if I'm one of those other campaigns, if I'm Biden or Buttigieg or Warren or Klobuchar for that matter, I am like getting ready to shoot that second number out, or I should say that first raw vote out of a cannon. Right. Because if you go in there and you get 12% of the vote or whatever, there's a lot of a noise to signal ratio opportunities with that. Well, here we are, folks. Going to be a nutso 11 months or 10 months from here on in, as if like the last 10 months have been, you know.
This is the fun part.
Yeah, at least now the waiting is over. And it's going to come rapid fire. Just to remind, well, we'll go over this tonight. See you in the fun half. Oh, wait. I should just say, don't forget, you can support this program by becoming a member. Join themajorityreport.com. Your support makes this show possible. Also, the AM Quickie. The numbers have been going up. Like, our graph is like this right now. People are enjoying the show. 8 a.m., we get it out, and you know we're perfecting the voice of it. And check it out, amquickie.com. It's available on our app, of course. TMBS, when is the show?
Wednesday TMBS this week.
Wednesday TMBS. So you can check that out at patreon.com/TMBS. And the Antifada, check that out, patreon.com/TheAntifada. And of course, Literary Hangover.
I released about an hour and a half of me reading couplets from Ebenezer Cook's poetry from the early 1700s. So
I didn't understand any
that's,
of that.
That's
I didn't
available.
Understand. Like, I didn't
I'm sure
understand
everybody else
like,
did.
Kubiatric.
Get on it, folks.
Hudibras was a it's a Yeah, we won't get into that. But anyway, check it out on the public feed. And Alex and I will have a new episode this weekend talking about Bacon's Rebellion. And that's one of the subjects of the poem.
So. You didn't put the poem behind the paywall?
Initially, they were behind the paywall, but now they're
released, available ladies and for gentlemen. Everybody. They're free now. There you go. I can't wait for like all this stuff just blows away. And then just like 50 years from now, my kids are passing on your books on or poetry readings.
I'm bringing Ebenezer Cook's 300-year-old words back to life.
That's huge.
I mean, I like it.
See you in the fun half. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agreed.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.